is great nostalgia for the heydays of filmmaking at Channel 4 when they had lots of budgets. And I was just saying that we filmed for something like 4 months, I think. And partly because Phyllis was so loved on the island, Phyllis stroke Joan, because I think Joan is her daughter really good, isn't she? She's the closest Phyllis in my experience. And because the island is so unused to having a film crew there, I think we were the very first film crew to ever be there, they sort of, in their minds, as a child would, who hasn't come across film making before, treated us as if we were those people. So I got treated as Madame, and Joan got treated as Joan, and so on. And it was rather wonderful because it meant it felt that we were invited in, and everybody was in the way that Dominicans are, extremely friendly and extremely tolerant. And for me, it was altogether a joyous experience, and was the beginning really of a love affair with the island. And it was for me very lucky later that I had the opportunity to play Jean Rhys, whom I had grown up through my teens reading and loving. I think I'd read just about everything she ever read. I was at university when White Sugar SSC was first published, so I read that first and then went back through all that. But Phyllis was somebody I had not come across at all. And I don't know quite, perhaps you know, Polly, how it came to be made at that point.
Well, it was Horace Over.
Was it Horace?
Yes.
Horace's inspiration.
Yes.
Horace is the director, Trinidad Lynch, director of some distinction, who made mainly documentaries up to that point, I think.
Yes, he made Pressure, which was the first. That was his first film here, which is about black experience here, which was very early, I think, in the 70s, early 70s. I'm not quite sure. That was a feature film, that wasn't a documentary.
Yes, that's right.
But he knew Dominica a bit, I think. But I really don't know quite how
I think,
he fell into the...
Yes, I don't know how well he knew the island. I mean, he of course knew Trinidad very well.
Yes.
He and his wife both were Trinidad.
Yes.
And it's his daughter who plays
Cornelia
Indra,
yes.
Looking very ravishing, I thought.
Yes.
And who's still an actress, I think. So what can I tell you? It's one of the great joys of being an actor that you suddenly are introduced to a whole new world, and you have to immerse yourself in it and pretend that you've always known it, and it was not that difficult to do. I now, sort of 20 years on in my career, I find myself listening very critically to everybody's accents because I think I don't think I was this afternoon for my cold reading, but I think I've become much more expert at accents, and I think we're all over the place and being very approximate, and accents came and went. And I don't think anybody ever made a choice about whether the family, about whether the master and madame's family had it, were creolized and had, you know, had a more of an accent, or whether they, certainly the girls who all escaped, of course, and come back, escaped in terms of how the family think about it, and then they come back, so they bring a whiff of a different world. But I think I made a deliberate choice to become more Dominican, become more of the island as I got older, to be more connected to the island. Especially from having been there alone for such a long time without my husband, and then effectively alone because he retreats into his addiction. I think it's probably better if people ask questions rather than me just wittering on, if there's anything specifically that anybody wants to know.
So, could you talk a little bit about your engagement with the novel in order to prepare for this? Did you, how did you prepare to, did you see differences between the script and the novel? I'm just very curious as to...
Well, I think it's hard for me to remember in detail,
yeah.
Lisa, what that process was now. But always, as an actor, you always start from the script.
Yeah.
And actually, I realised that I don't know what became of that screenwriter, Jim. I don't know if he's gone on to do other things. Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a hired hand, presumably, to do it. And so I was engaged, and I said yes to it on the strength of reading the script. And then once I was cast and knew that I was going to be playing, then one goes back to the novel with an almost forensic interest and goes through and picks up every little clue. And actually, because Phyllis Awfrey was such a nuanced writer, often the things that one picks up are not specified, but they're implied in actions or in things that don't happen. I'd have to sit and do a close study of the text to be able to tell you that. But one goes through it like a Sherlock, and underlines every little clue. And the way that I was trained was that you do it, of course you do it for your own character first, but then you do it for every other character, and then you do lists of what every other character says about you, and then you do lists of what you say about every other character. And so you gradually wind yourself into the story. I mean, that's a purely acting technique. And I think I'm quite lucky that I have a literary background. I studied literature for 5 years before I became an actor. So it's quite useful for sort of textual analysis and so on, and narrative structures. And it's quite hard to play somebody who you first meet as a relatively young married woman, and then you have to jump over time when the story goes on to focus really on what happens 20 years later when the girls have grown up. And you suddenly have to bring that, the experience and the loneliness and also the compliance, complacence with Mademoiselle and with Lally to the screen. And I think one of the things that's always very difficult with adaptations is, and this one was unusual because that's why I say I speak with nostalgia of the time when there was big budgets, because money means time, really, in filming terms. And I had the same experience when filming Brideshead, which is that if there is money, then you film every detail of the book. You can translate page by page, more or less, to the screen. And what has happened in almost every other television adaptation since then is the budgets have shrunk, and so the amount of screen time to tell the story shrinks. And so although the narrative structure may be broadly the same, sometimes a subplot will have to be excised altogether, but on the whole the narrative structure remains the same, but there's no room for little scenes where not very much happens that moves the narrative forward, and those are the scenes where you can really develop a character, because you just see the character living. So, I mean, it happened a little bit with this, that as the story goes on, you sort of leapfrog from crisis to crisis. You know, you've cut to the strike, you've cut to Joan's involvement in it, and as I remember, you leap over some of the thing which is established much more gently. Her relationship with Baptiste is much more gradual, and Andrew's relationship with, what's her name?
Coralie
is more delicately introduced and so on. So, but what happens in a TV adaptation, of course it is a different medium, so it's not entirely unwelcome, but those have to be givens, and your job as an actor is to come on and just do it, and the audience has to catch up with it. And it's not always successful. In a way, a novel is much more satisfactory way of getting to understand the subtleties of a context, if you like. And Horace was very good, actually. Horace really knew what he wanted very clearly, and he was very specific in his direction.
Yes, I was wondering whether the fact that he was from the Caribbean was important.
I think it was very important.
Yes, and how did he direct the non-Caribbean actors in a way that you were sort of learning how to be your character?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I can't think of specific moments, but you just felt that he had great authority because he was speaking about a world that he pretty well knew and had grown up in and still loved, you know, was still part of. So I think it would have been a less trustworthy, a account of the book if it had been made by a non-Caribbean director. It was terribly important. He and his wife too, who was a co-producer on the film. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it would have been like if there had, if they had found actors who had actually grown up in the Caribbean to play the family, because we were all imports from Britain. And I felt, I did actually feel that it was a great advantage to have known the work of Gene Reeves, actually. And I had read a biography of him by then, I think. So all of that was very useful. And the fact that we were there for such a long time, you know, and living, I didn't live in a hotel, I took an apartment and went to market, and my little girl was there. And actually, it was a curious thing, this is completely anecdotal and nothing to do with your studies, but I was there with my 19-year-old niece, who was on the payroll to tutor my 7-year-old daughter. And my mother paid for my this particular niece's sister, my other niece from that family, to come out with their mother for a holiday. And so we were a woman and three other women, or three young girls and two older women, living in the apartment for a while. And the girls would all, and my, I include my sister and the girls, although she's older than me, would all disappear and go and enjoy the island. And we were filming very early, because that was the only disadvantage, is it was getting hot. I think we were there, I can't remember the months, but it was something like February to the end of June or something that we were there. So by the end of filming, it was very hot and steaming. And for instance, some of my costumes just disintegrated and had to be replaced. They started off, that was a learning curve, I think. The designer hadn't worked in a rainforest climate before. And the silk, and a lot of it was period silk, and you just get up in the morning to put it on again, and it would just fall into shreds. And so we discovered that we were much better off wearing cotton on the home. But anyway, my sister and my nieces went out every night to have fun, and mainly dancing. And I'd get up very early in the morning, we were filming very early before it got too hot, and I'd get up at 4:30 or something, and there'd be nobody to leave my baby with, because they were still out having fun. And indeed, my sister met somebody who was Dominican, came back, had just celebrated her 25th wedding anniversary, came back to England and couldn't forget him, and promptly left home and spent the next 15 years with him. So she then had a very close connection with the island, and although he was only returning to Dominica to see his mother settle there, he in fact took my sister there very often, so she's had a long connection with the island, and I've just been an occasional visitor. So. But it is funny, that curious thing sometimes of life mirroring art. You know, I was very conscious of my time in this very lovely teak flat, looking out over the Caribbean with a household of women.
Well, thank you very much, Diana, for sharing.
I'm sorry, that is entirely anecdotal.
That's absolutely great. In a couple of minutes, we'll move on to our final reading of the day, and then we'll break open the wine and perhaps chat less formally about some of the ideas that have come up today. I think there are a lot of connections to be made and perhaps unpacked a little. But again, thank you very much, Diana.
And see what happens.
Yes.
I'm sorry. And maybe do read that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what we're doing in this last session is one short, maybe another, possibly another extract from In the Cabinet, which is Phyllis Alfred's unfinished and unpublished novel. It's 'tis mainly about her experience in the Federation. It's almost not fiction, but fact. I suspect there is not an invented line in it, although it's written as if to pretend that it's fiction. It's a real jumble. I don't think anybody really, although I suspect maybe we should put it online, but I think it probably wouldn't enhance her reputation in a way to publish it. But it is incredibly Phyllis Alfrey, and the extract that Trish's going to read is when Phyllis Alfrey goes to Trinidad, having been elected to be a member of the West Indies Federation, and she becomes the Minister for Labour and Social Affairs. She's the only woman in the cabinet, she's the only white person in the cabinet. And Phyllis was a very totally non-materialist person, extremely disorganised, never sort of cared about her clothes or her hair or big social events or anything like that. Anyhow, so she finds herself in Trinidad as in this sort of very rather sort of conventional ministerial environment. And this little extract is about her having to attend a party as the Minister for Labour and Social Affairs. But first of all, there is this tiny little poem that she wrote, which we should have put in the collected poems, but we didn't, which she put at the beginning. She didn't give it a title, but the book is called In the Cabinet, so this is an 8-line poem.
In the cabinet of life, poverty, achievement, strife. In the cabinet of heart, embedded deep a nuclear doubt. Cabinet of politics, noble aims and dirty tricks. Cabinet of eternity, I, and you, and me.
And so, and this is her being told that she has to go to this party, she has to host this party.
On the afternoon of my ministerial reception for 60 guests, I reflected how I had never given a real party for more than 16 people in all of my life, and then under great strain. Fortunately, the hotel was doing all the catering. My permanent secretary and Dr. Musai did all the rest of the planning. Before I left my office to dress, he handed me a list of surnames. There were no Christian names or prefixes. I asked mildly, "How many of these guests are ladies?" Dr. Musai looked incredibly shocked. "Ladies? This is a party for the Regional Labour Board, a stag party, of course. So you mean I'm to give a stag party tonight?" "Certainly, Minister." I could see he thought I was being naive and difficult. He added in a gentle, persuasive tone, "You probably realise by now that ministers are sexless." Outside my office building, a pale yellow taxi waited. It was a personal taxi which had attached itself to me until such time as I could afford to buy a car of my own. The driver was a citizen of my home island, and he gave me to understand that he was my friend, my bodyguard, my loyal adherent. This voluntary information proved entirely true. His presence in the wicked big island comforted me inordinately. I said to him, "Nicholas, I have to give a party for 6 gentlemen of the Regional Labour Board on the roof of the hotel. Don't worry, they're harmless, said Nicholas. But let me warn you of something, ma'am. The lobster those waiters put out on the table up there, it isn't fresh lobster. Don't try to take a claw. It is only stuffed with cotton wool. Is he set out for style? I thanked him agreeably. When you set up housekeeping, I'll be your caterer, said Nicholas. There'll be no swindling charges, and the stuffed eggs will be stuffed in a special way. The drinks will be properly measured. It was then that I discovered how it is essential to have stuffed eggs at any major social event in Trinidad. Anyone who does not have stuffed eggs loses face. I lost face once or twice, but soon I learned to conform, reminded by Nicholas, who also told me never to eat the last stuffed eggs on a plate. They were usually full of germs due to handling being so slippery. Back up in my igloo, I turned off the cooler and had a warm shower. I didn't like being too cool. It was not my climate. After all, generations since 1640 had distilled me at a certain temperature. I hesitated between the Virtue Dutch locket and Aunt Max's pearls, which I would soon have to send back by registered post. I sat on one of the beds and lifted the telephone. In the whole of that host island, so adroitly had the colonists of the past kept us strangers from each other, I knew only one young woman, an American. In a moment, she answered my ring. Donna, doing anything tonight? Well, no, I thought of going to a movie. I'm giving a stag party for 60. Yoo-hoo! Would you like to come? I have no qualm about what Dr. Moose would say. Would I? It's the Regional Labour Board. Do you know what that is? Certainly not. Does it matter? It does to me. Try not to be so frivolous. Remember, I'm a minister. Whoopee, cried Donna. I'll be right over. I received at the entrance of the roof garden. The guests came up decorously, behaved with charm, curiosity, and circumspection, their faces darkly interesting under the lights. Far off to sea, the great turbulent shape of Venezuela humped up, and silhouetted against it was the slender chic silhouette of Donna, glass in hand, several handsome gentlemen looming over her. The party ended too soon, long before I'd learned the identities of most of my guests, though Dr. Moose I tried hard to put me wise. I wanted to talk lengthily and seriously to them. Those were the men who dealt with countries, who knew about labor boards, migrants, wage rates, and so forth. Finally, Donna and I stood looking at the lobster. We were tired, but gay.
I think we are running out of time,
yeah.
And perhaps now is the time to break open the wine and let the chat. Thank you very much
for
that.
Thank you.